My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clancy.
I'm very glad to be here tonight. Jim, you drank all the water out of the speaker's water, for crying out loud. That wasn't for you. That's why I have to bring my people. I'm very glad to be here. Every year Jim has some new surprise for us. Tonight we had an Al-Anon participate. That's the first. Maybe I'll talk about my overeating. Well, didn't mean to strike a nerve. But I'm very glad to be here. And some of you have... You know, I'd laugh. Get a little tough over here in West Covina, where the treasurer and the secretary both beg you to bring the baskets back. Please bring them back again. I should say that this is the 35th year I've come out here at Christmas time. And we've had the society works in decimals. There should be some little gift for 35. I got a gift. Let me tell you an interesting story. In the 1700s and 1800s in India, the Mughals, which were known as the emperors, were known as the Mughals. And if they wanted to destroy someone, they would present them with a white elephant. Because the white elephant was sacred and could not be killed or destroyed or gotten rid of. And these white elephants needed a great deal of expensive care and much expensive food. And when he gave a white elephant to someone, it would eventually bankrupt them. That's where the term white elephant comes from. I got a white elephant. Something is of no use whatsoever and bankrupts you. It's also known as the Shetland pony ploy. On my 20th year out here, they brought in a Shetland pony from the back. Because I used to complain when I was a little boy. I never had a pony, so all I ever wanted was a pony. And that night, Harvey Andrews was sitting down here, and he leaped up with a hoarse cry. He said, "I can't stand anymore here." And I thought, what, he's going crazy, the poor bastard. So he ran outside, and that was the end of that. The person who came in the back door leading a pony, an old Shetland pony, you know, big long yellow fangs, and brought him out here. If you hear a tape of that, it means just a consistent scream for about 10 minutes. And I thought it was some sort of a, one of the few times I was ever speechless. I just had a little red blanket on, said Clancy's pony. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good joke, Harvey. Get it out of here, for Christ's sake. Come on, this is an AA meeting after all. Then I thought that was the end of it. At the end of the meeting, the secretary got up and he thanked the coffee makers and he thanked the readers and he thanked the people who chipped in to buy this pony for the speaker. And the next day, a truck backed up in my backyard and his pony got out. And he's been living in my backyard ever since. As late as the 5 o'clock this afternoon, I was out giving him more hay and trying to curry favor with him, and he crapped on my foot. Come to think of it, I don't want any more gifts from this group. None. It is a very nice affair, though. As most of you know, and I hate to be... I was not nice. That guy sat down and saved that seat. So when she came in, she could sit down, and he's getting up and going home. Most of you know the story. It's a tedious, dull story, but for those of you who haven't been here, in 1950, 1960, somebody, Christmas Eve fell on Saturday night, And someone called the 63, they tried to get a speaker to come to this dreary little West Covina meeting, and they couldn't get any speaker. Nobody wanted to come out, nobody decent would come out on Christmas Eve. So they called the 6300 Club, which was the AA Club, and I lurked over there at that time, and they called up, said they need a speaker, and I, since I'd answered the phone, I thought, here's my chance to make my move. So I said, yes, well, I'll come out there and speak, So I hustled some guy to give me a ride out, got a shirt and tie somewhere, and it was the basement of a church or Legion Hall or American Legion Hall, and went down there and about 15 or 20 dreary people, nothing better to do on Christmas Eve, none of them had any friends or loved ones, just... And I felt kind of bad because I had lost my children, I'd lost my home, I'd lost everything else. Living in a little one-room apartment in Hollywood. And I had sent my children their gifts about the 15th, and that was the end of Christmas for me. And I thought, why am I out in the country? None of these people will even remember what I say anyway, because they're obviously not even tracking. So I could really let them know what I thought. So I gave quite a talk about Christmas. I said, you know, Christmas when I was a little boy, it was a lovely thing. And I really enjoyed it. My grandparents would go to their house, and my uncle Warren and Aunt Alma come down from Minneapolis. They all smoke cigars, and our associate cigar smoke on Christmas Eve. We'd open our presents, and so wonderful and touching. And sometimes we'd sing, my grandma and grandpa would sing a hymn in Norwegian, and just so beautiful. We'd eat fattig man buckles and sun buckles and scroll buckles, and just wonderful things. And as I grew older, I kind of always wanted to retain that, but it all went to hell. And then my life went off in different slants, and their lives went off, and they're dead. And it's just, and as I grow up, Christmas has become just a commercial mishmash, and nobody really cares. It's how much bucks you could make out of Christmas. Christmas stinks, you know. But for Christmas, it's a terrible thing. And I gave a kind of a, not exactly what you'd call an upbeat Christmas talk. And I got done. I thought I probably depressed these people so bad. I'll never be invited to speak in the San Gabriel Valley again. But that's all right. I gave my shot. And after the meeting, some guy came up. The guy that led the meeting said, "Boy, that really was good. You want to come and speak next Christmas?" All right. So I came and spoke next Christmas and gave him the same ration of how futile Christmas is and what a rotten, phony commercial bunch of crap, and they liked that again. So the same guy asked me about the following year, and now it's been 35 years I've been coming out here, and oddly enough, the guy that led the meeting that night and the guy that asked me to come back is the guy that's leading the meeting tonight, and he's led every one of the meetings except one year, and he got mad at me because he felt I'd attacked his grandson. I really hadn't. I was just joking with him. But I always felt that I didn't blame Jim for that, because I feel the same way. But it's been 35 years now, and it's an amazing thing. How many, I've never done this before, but I've done this before. I know there are a few. Would the people that were at that meeting in 1960 stand up? I'd like to see them. There's one, two, three, four, five back there. All right. Well, there's maybe six or seven here of those 20, and that's 35 years ago. That's a pretty good lick. Because in most of the world, people don't stay sober 30, if anybody stays sober 35 months, they become the old timer in their group. And here, 35 years doesn't even make you the old timer. And it's really remarkable, because it's, maybe there's a moral there somewhere, that people who are even willing to go to AA meetings on Christmas Eve stay sober. I don't know. People have some sort of a intention to do something about this. And it's a baffling thing. Alcoholism is a baffling thing. You know, one of the most amazing things to sponsors or to friends or to anybody, and you see it a lot, the same people, when we sit in our group, same people go to the same meetings, listen to the same speakers, sit in the same rows, do the same things, and some of them can't stay sober, and some grab a hold of it and stay sober forever. And it's just baffling. It goes back to like watching families. I'm sure it's like watching families. You know, they always talk about, well, is it the genes that makes kids go bad or good? Or is it the environmental conditioning, the nurturing and so forth? And I'll tell you, you look at any large family or small family for that matter, in any family, children sitting in the same house with the same genes and the same parents and the same schools and the same education and the same environment, and three or four turn out well and two or three just become absolutely no good. And it's just baffling, and nobody can really understand why. And, well, it's the environment. It wasn't the environment on them. It must be the gene or the genes on them. And it's the same thing here. It's the most dreadful and baffling thing. Why can't some people stay sober here? There are people who come here again and again and again. And I have an empathy for them because I did that year after year after year after year after year. I sat in AA meetings in various parts of the country. I certainly didn't go every week after a while, but I went intermittently when the heat was on, and I could never understand it. People that I would hire to mow my lawn could stay sober. Guys that were multimillionaires could stay sober. It had nothing to do with economics. People that weren't as smart as I am were staying sober. People that, as far as I could tell, were smarter than I was were staying sober. I don't like pain. I'm not into pain. I'm not into failure. I don't like to go to some place and fail. And it's just baffling. I want to stay sober as bad as anybody. And these people find some way to do it, and staying sober just makes me crazy till I can't stand it. Now, why is that? And that is the continual bafflement of the treatment of alcoholics, and has been for all of mankind, except for most of mankind. There's never been anyone who did stay sober. It's only been the last, as we've talked about before, there's only been two brief periods. So there's ever been any place for people like you and me to go with this peculiar situation. One briefly in the 1840s, something called the Washingtonians, that by the time we got to be in 1845, that expanded to many, many thousands of sober drunks. And then they made what seemed to be intellectually correct decision, because there are still people in Los Angeles or in AA in the world who believe that they should do it. They felt they should carry their message to all people who suffer. So they didn't just help alcoholics anymore, they began to help non-alcoholics and narcotics addicts and politically oppressed people. So they begin to help people who want to stamp out the sale of alcohol. And they wanted to help all sorts of people. And in 3 years, the Washingtonians were extinct, and all those many thousands of people apparently died drunk. And the only other time, that is why they talk so much here about you must be an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because it's better or worse than anything else, but because non-alcoholics do not respond to the same things that we respond to. We have a great deal of difficulty getting ourselves to respond, and people who do not have this intangible something have nothing to communicate to me. Over the years I've been to a lot of meetings, GA and OA and NA, and I really appreciate what they're trying to do, and I wish them well. But when they talk, it's just information. When I hear some woman say, "I ate two chickens," I think, you ought to do something about that, for Christ's sake. I hear somebody say, I ate so much ice cream I couldn't eat anymore. I put my finger down my throat, and I ate some more. I thought, Jesus, don't shake hands with me after the meeting. Old slimy finger. And the reason for that is I intellectually know that it's what they're doing, but I get no visceral or emotional response to it, because I don't get that response from food. I get that from alcohol. When people talk to me about how they drink, and they can feel their fingers tingle, and things look different, and things start to change, non-alcoholics say, huh. But you and I, or most of you, are alcoholics. Say, yeah. Yeah. Makes your tongue dart out for a while. And that's what, because there's no information here. There's no information here that's new or unusual or wonderful. There's nothing here you're going to learn here. You can learn in 20 other places. In fact, if advice made you sober, nobody would be here. Because I personally, I'm sure you're the same, I've had enough advice to last me 3,000 years. I had enough advice to last me for 1,000 years by the time I was 21. And I got it from good people and friends of my family and doctors and judges and lawyers and loving people and principals and deans of universities. And I listened, but didn't seem to have any application to me because they didn't understand me. They didn't, my case was different. The thing that helped me the most in my life was not advice, was not information. I went to psychoanalysis to get to the root of my unease. Now, as I often say, there's people in AA who say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I particularly loved it because I found breakthroughs that put things into perspective I never would have dreamed. I discovered I'd been hurt in ways I hadn't even guessed. I just... none of my brothers or sisters ever turned out well in the environment I was in. Mainly because I didn't have any brothers and sisters. But if I would have, they'd have been hurt too, the way I was. I could see that. And I was hurt by the Norwich Lutheran Church. And I was hurt by all sorts of things. And I loved it. I loved psychoanalysis. I spent a lot more money than I can afford. And I had it. I often wonder why I loved it so well. And looking back, I know why I loved it. Because it did something that modern therapies do. Instead of the inner child therapy and some of the adult child therapies do. It removes my guilt. It removed my guilt briefly. And you wonder how it removes your guilt? Yeah, I'll tell you how these therapies remove guilt. By convincing the patient that he or she is and has always been a victim. When I am a victim, things are no longer my fault. I have been made this way by unfeeling hands. It's not my fault. And that's what makes victimization therapy so popular. They're the hottest things in America right now, these victimization therapies, where people just go there and spend a lot of money. I'm not talking about the adult children that comes through Al-Anon. I'm talking about the professional, commercial adult children movement, where they get into these movements and there's never any exit because you never change your status. And I'm not, I sound as though I'm being very judgmental, but I'm not. In my experience, for people like me, what they bring about continual resentment of those who have hurt you. They bring about terrible, endless feelings of being different, that I've been warped and so screwed up as a kid that I can't possibly turn out anything well. And it gives me an endless, intermittent, but intense self-pity. Why me? Why have my life been like this? Why couldn't I have just been like the others? Why couldn't I have had a happy life? Why do I have to live in this unnatural situation? The only thing they didn't have then that they have now is they didn't have the word dysfunctional then. If I'd have had that, I'd have gone for another 6 months for that. And I loved psychoanalysis. I finally ran out of dough. You know, I spent much of my life that way. I'm sure many people in this room have. I've always had the feeling, if I can just find out why I have these feelings of inadequacy sometimes, and these feelings of not fitting in, and the feelings that I'm too sensitive and people hurt my feelings a lot, and the feelings, these are not things that I would ever tell anybody or show anybody. I'd make a point to conceal them, but I always knew I had them. And I just hated these kind of feelings. And I thought, if I could just find out where these feelings come from, where did they come from? What happened? What was done to me to bring this about? I thought, if I could just find out why, I'll be all right. And I'm sure there are people in this room, a lot of them, who are looking on that path right now, trying to determine, why do I have these feelings? Why do I have these intensities? Why do I have these ups and downs? Let me give you some hope. You can find out why you have those feelings. And I think in several different therapies, actually, you may get different answers, but they all seem valid. You can find out why. And I found out why in at least two different therapies. The negative part is, it doesn't help. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. That's about it, you know. And the only possible use I've ever been able to think of for that information is that, you know, maybe some night late at night in a bar, be standing there and some big moose come over and say, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And then you can tell him. I wasn't sufficiently nurtured as a child of an original from church repressed. Ah, shut up. An old analogy I used to say, but I haven't said it for a long time, so I want to hear it one more time. I've lived my life as though I were on the deck of the Titanic. And it hits the iceberg, and down it goes. And everybody rows away as fast as they can. And people like me say, "I'm not getting off this baby till I find out why this happened." And you may find out why, and it gives you a real kind of a wave of exultation. "You people out in the boats! I know why." It takes a heap of living to realize knowing why you're going down is of no value whatsoever. You got to get off the ship is what you got to do. But when I was a boy, 15 years old, I was restless and discontent, and my parents had divorced, which was no big thing then, now, but then I had never heard of a divorce till my parents got divorced. That's a kind of milieu I lived in. And they were very religious in my church, and divorce was unheard of. And which in itself wasn't so bad. A lot of kids want a divorce. But me, without ever having seen a divorce or heard of a divorce, I instinctively reacted to it as though I'd been around them all my life and had selected the wrong, worst way to handle it. Without even missing a beat, I began instinctively playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline. When my father was on my case, I'd run to my mother and tell her tales about him. And when she got on me, I'd run to my father and tell him tales about her. And when they both got on me intermittently, I'd run to my grandmother and tell her tales about all of them. And which was got me out of a lot of things. Sorry, just a conditioned reflex. I'm a trained killer, Kevin. I'm trying to make this a long talk so Kevin will have a new sobriety record. I'm hoping is you say, "I'll stay sober and show that dirty son of a bitch." But I believe that most of my problems in my life began in that period. Because I'd been raucous before that, but I was bright, and I'd skipped a grade and a half in school at Christmas time one year, and I wasn't really, I was on the playgrounds, I was the captain of my baseball team, whatever it might be, and I was always involved in everything. Once I got shoved ahead in school, I fell behind a little bit. But I was doing all right. When I was about 12, I don't want to get into some psychological thing here, but when I began losing that discipline, I think there's a passage of life there must be somewhere. Because I fell behind there, and I'll tell you, I was learning lessons at 35 and 40 that I should have gained when I was 13 and 14, I think. It just is a dumb thing. And when I was 15, I was about to flunk out of high school. I felt bad. The war had just been on for a little while. I wanted to do something. I wanted to get out of here, and I felt silly. And one day my mother told me I was going to visit my aunt in Superior, and she packed my little bag and gave me bus fare. And I hitchhiked to San Francisco. had no idea where the hell I was going. He was the dumbest little kid you ever, this high, pimply face, dummy. But they were just crying for merchant seamen, and I got one ride all the way from Minneapolis to San Francisco. I was standing up, some guy said, "Stand here and hitchhike." And the guy said, "Where are you going?" I said, "San Francisco." He said, "Good." So am I. Hop in, and away we went. Yeah. I did not use the Navy. He was going to San Francisco to be returning to a ship, but I was just some kind of a humorous addition to his travel, I guess, you know. But I was the dumbest little kid. He'd ask me questions about life, and I'd tell him. And we'd, at night, we'd stop, and he would stop. And they were more like trailer courts than not motels. But I didn't know. He would get me a place to sleep, and he'd buy my meals, and all these things. We traveled for days. I thought about that later, you know. I didn't even think it was unusual. I just thought, that's what happens when you hitchhike. I'd never hitchhiked before. You just tell them where you're going, and they get you there. Yeah. And I got to San Francisco, and he showed me where the Coast Guard office was. He said, don't try to be in the Navy. You can't get in the Navy. Tell them you want to be in the Merchant Marine. So I filled out application, put down 16, lied my age, and they said I'd have to have my parents' permission. So I took the application on the block, got my parents' permission, brought it back. And they were so crying for seamen in those days, they issued me seamen's papers right there. And they sent me to the National Maritime Union down in the Embarcadero, and I slept down there, and I signed a waiver for my union dues. And they sent me the union was on Montgomery Hill. They sent me to the Embarcadero where the ships were. And I took on this enormous ship, and away we went. And the afternoon I got to San Francisco, I was on my way to the South Pacific. And I remember standing there, and there was Treasure Island. People said, "That's where the World's Fair was last year." We went by Alcatraz. That was exciting. I tried to look, see if I could find Al Capone or Machine Gun Kelly. I mean, the Golden Gate Bridge. And the damn ship just kept going. And the earth began falling out of sight astern. And I think I had an intuitive feeling that I had made the first in an endless series of career errors. I went to some guy, I said, "You know, I really appreciate this opportunity, but I shouldn't be getting back then. We have a big English test Monday," and he wished me well, told me to luck off. He said, "Get to your forecastle." I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it sounded ominous. I went to this, turned out to be a sleeping room, as you find out, but I didn't know that. And he was in this room with three of the worst type of people that a small, skinny, pimply-faced, dumb kid can be with. These kind of people are called men. And they looked at me, and I now know why they looked at me, so because I was the fourth member of their deck watch. And when they saw me, they realized they were each going to be doing one and a third men's work for the rest of that ship. And, I could see there's a little tension in the air, so I told them some stories that used to be go over good in study hall. And
why don't you get your goddamn bunk and shut up?
So that seemed to be a good idea. And it was just a terrible trip. I mean, I didn't do much. I got to be their whipping boy. I got to be their Quasimodo if they're, you know, never had an idle time, something to do. Say, "Hey, kid, go down to the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench." "Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we want some elbow grease." And one of the things they did in that ship was offer me a drink of whiskey. And I had been kind of a bad kid, not a bad kid, but a wild kid. But I never drank any whiskey, and I was never going to drink any whiskey. But when they pulled the bottle in my face and said, "You think you're man enough to take a drink of whiskey?" I was building up my arguments to point out why I wouldn't. And I heard a voice say, "God damn right." And I took a drink of whiskey and it made me throw up, and they laughed at me and ridiculed me. So all the way across the Pacific Ocean, while we were going along, you know, at least once a day, I guess, I'd sneak into this guy's sea bag, or one of these guys' sea bag, have a bottle, I'd take a drink of that, and I'd throw it up, because it always made me throw up so terrible, so sick, and they laughed at me and ridiculed. I mean, I did when nobody was looking. I had the feeling, if I could drink and not throw up, they'll think I'm a man. I had no idea. They didn't think I was a man because I wasn't a man. It wasn't because they didn't throw up some whiskey. But on that ship also, I finally held a drink down. And then when nobody was around. And then I turned out I couldn't breathe. And then something else happened. All of a sudden, when I didn't throw it up, I found myself feeling significantly better. I felt warm all over and tingling, and I realized that's why people drink. Because it makes you feel better. You know, I've always envied these people who've had great breakthroughs and have insights and understandings that I don't have. I heard a guy a couple of years ago, he said, "But I held that drink down. I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience with many flowers and many buds and many fruits to be partaken of over the coming years." I thought, geez, I wish I'd known that, you know. All I knew is, if you drink, if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. That's all I was talking about. And I drank, and I didn't become a terrible old drunk. I just, like everything else, I learned to smoke on that ship. I learned to swear. Learned to talk about girls, fantasize about, I'd fantasize about them, but I never talked about them. And I did no big deal. I didn't become a big drunk. I just drank, and sometimes got drunk and threw up, and I got to be funny doing that, and funny vomiting, smoking, funny doing, you know, just a goof. And later in the war, I got old enough, I went in the Navy, and I drank some more there, not a terrible drinker. But you know, it's a funny thing, when you're young, it seems like you can bounce back. You can get up in the morning after 2 hours sleep. It's kind of hard when you get old. But anyway, at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up in Pleasanton, California, and I was good on tests. They passed around some tests. I took a test, and on the basis of that, they gave me a high school diploma, which I never realized at the time, but changed my life. If I wouldn't have got that diploma, or that certificate, I would have had to go back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and start my junior year of high school after the war. And I never would have done that, never in a thousand years. But so I was able to go to college, the first year of veterans after the war, first class of veterans, and got married in college, went out in the world, became a sports writer. And little by little, as my family grew, I had to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations. And all these years, I drank. And I never paid much attention. Drinking was just something you did. We drank in college. You know, we'd get together a lot in college, talking about the war and drink, and mostly BS, but we'd drink about it, you know. And we had a lot of fun. It just was a very strong, tough era, it seemed to me. And when I got out, the people I ran with were drinkers. Because drinkers I like to be around drinkers because they're really people. I hate to be around pukes with little thin blue lips and... When I'm at night in a bar, I think about that. Think about this many times. You know, if I'm living in El Paso, as I was at one time, and at 1 o'clock in the morning, people says, "Hey, let's go to Juarez." I want to be around people who say, "Yeah." I don't want to be around a bunch of pukes who say, "Why? It's so late. What'll I tell Margaret? Tell her to keep you home, you wussy." I like to, just changes things. I want to be around people because they're fun guys. And I, drinking, although I never paid really a lot of attention to it, I look back and I see what drinking does for people like me. I thought it did it for everybody, but it turns out it doesn't. It takes people like me who don't feel like I'm enough. And when I have a few drinks, usually, I feel like I'm more than enough. It takes a guy like me with hurt feelings all the time. I hurt somebody else's feelings, as a rule. I don't give over my fear. I feel like I'm something. I feel the way people look. And I just love it. I love drinking. And you learn to love to drink things you like. I learned to like martinis and love them and drink those in my job situations. I learned to drink rum and Coca-Cola and in Texas. I drank so much rum, I got so I'd have a glass of water in the morning, I'd pass out. You just, that's what happens. That's why they call people rummy. You drink enough of that stuff, you just. But it's good. That's what counts. And I drank a lot of, I love beer, I love bourbon, I love all sorts of things, different things. And I love a lot of things. I love all kinds of things. It helps me engage in life. I know sometimes when I walk down the street and I'm on the wagon, remember talking about this years ago, I walk down the street on the wagon and you can see the cruddy buildings, you can see the cruddy people, and you can see what the cruddy place you are. But when you have a few drinks, you walk down the street, sometimes you get tears in your eyes over the beauty of the sunset. Just the wonderful people you know. Just, oh, shit, it's wonderful here. I know. That's a great feeling. My only problem is I have an intermittently unfortunate tendency to drink a little too much. And I overshoot. And I, as I found out later in psychoanalysis, that wasn't my fault either. I just, many times I've been thoughtlessly overserved. Then I have a tendency to get in jams, because I have a tendency to get bizarre. I discovered later in psychoanalysis that was because I had been repressed as a child, and I was just breaking loose my bonds. I tried to explain that to a cop one night, and he was not a student of psychoanalysis, apparently. But so I was, even when I was a kid, I was acting pretty, I love, that's the only time I feel except when I'm drinking. That's the only time, I thought about that later, you know. Here's the strange thing, in my life of repression. But I would say that probably, certainly in my chasing of girls, and even in marriage, I was sufficiently repressed. I could not go to bed with my wife and make love unless I was drinking. I could not do it sober. It was just something it was too, something inside of me. And just, that's the way my life was. That's why I drank. And that's why people felt I got a little bizarre when I drank. And that's why I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We're glad you're here. But I, well, you're forced to say that, you know. But I, didn't take me long, a few meetings to discover I don't belong here. Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people like me. It's for people whose problem is drinking. My problem is intermittent. Sometimes the pressures get to me and I drink too much. But these are people who can't drink at all. You know, my guys are saying things like, I stayed drunk every drink I took. And I came to this meeting. I've been sober. I've just felt wonderful. It's just doing me a world of good. Why don't you tell your face, you old puke? You know. But A is a great place for people whose problem is alcohol. My problem was trying to find the control of it. And I thought that made me entirely different. I didn't realize for years and years that I had just entered into the absolute middle of the road, trodden down path of alcoholism. And I'm sure to one extent or other, everybody in this room, the specifics vary, but what we have in common are so similar. Yes, in the last few years, as I've talked about before, because I've been active a lot, and I've been active a lot of years, I've been asked, had the opportunity to do something that not a lot of people haven't had a chance to do yet, and that is being asked to speak in various places around the world, in Cape Town, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and Dublin, and Belfast, and Amsterdam, and Paris, and Sydney, and Auckland, a lot of places. And you'd think you'd find all sorts of exotic alcoholism and exotic experiences and exotic approaches to a program there. And the most amazing thing of all is that if you can ignore the accents, you hear exactly the same talk you hear in this meeting or any meeting like it. And every meeting seems to be made up all over the world, this meeting and other meetings. As I look at it now from a different viewpoint, it almost looks like every Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is almost the same to one degree or another, whatever the size. There are some people here who have been able to find the program, do it, feel part of it, and believe in it. There's also in every meeting a group of people who come here who can't stay sober, who would like to perhaps, but eventually get cynical about it and come, and they come and they come and go and come and go. And in every group there's a group of newer people, and these two forces fight for their souls. This group says you got to do these inconvenient, unpleasant things, and this group says you don't have to do that stuff. And they both believe they're right. And it's the same thing all over the world. The universal cry of every alcoholic in the world that I know of, at one time or another, is always the same. But my case is different. We all know our case is different, which makes it kind of funny when you think about it, but it isn't funny because that's what causes people to die. In my work today, as some of you know, I see every so often somebody die from alcoholism, and sometimes go mad from alcoholism, that irreversible insanity. And I know a way out. I want to just shake him and say, come on! I know where you've been, and I'm doing fine. And they can't do it because they've got so far into their feelings of difference that they can't. The seal is closed. The door is no longer open. Just as the words are bouncing off right 3 feet. And I know that feeling because I've sat so many times and people talk to me and I just, like intercontinental ballistic missiles, just shot down their words before they ever got to me. I know you mean well, but you don't understand. I have these special problems. I have these special emotions. I have this special history. I have this special something. I have this special ethnic background. I have this special something. But I know this, my case is different. And AA works very well for people whose problem is drinking, but it doesn't seem to have much effect on people like me who use drinking to help themselves with their problem. Different proposition. I remember sitting in meetings over the years thinking, I wish I could be like these people. I wish I were simple like these people. I could understand that. But there's something different about me. You know, the last day I drank, I'd had some successes, I'd had some failures, and most of you, this tedious story. And finally, the last day of my drinking, I found myself, two big guys throwing me out of the midnight mission on Skid Row. And I didn't even know anybody within 1,000 miles to speak of. And I wasn't here, I was just on the run from Texas where they're going to put me back in the insane asylum. And everything was gone. My home was gone. Everything was gone. I stood outside the midnight mission in the morning, much like this morning. Cold, only a little light drizzle. And cold. And I'd lost my clothes. And I'd had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank 3 or 4 weeks before. And everything was gone. And whether I get to the part where I get leukemia and die, you like that? If Johnny Harris would give that kind of talk, people would cry for 2 hours. Oh, Johnny, that's so goddamn beautiful. I talk about dying. But if I was staff on some admission, and I'd had some success, I'd been on the faculty of the University of Texas, I'd been ad or kept writing ads, some of them were appearing that week, the LC Number ads were running, among the most successful ads in America at that time. I had my picture in the New York Times once for an achievement I'd done. Yeah, but now it was all gone, gone with the wind, terror was gone and I was gone. And I was telling him, if a man would have come up to me and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're about 100 pounds. Your family is gone. You have no idea where they are. Your home is gone. Your parents will not accept a collect phone call from you.
You can't think of anybody in America that accept a phone call from you. I'm sure there were people who would have, but I didn't know who they were. And everybody, no one's really angry at you. They're just so disappointed in you that you've broken your promises so many, many times. No one wants to hear from you anymore. Even your own mother doesn't want to hear from you because you're going to break her heart. Now, you've been going to AA for years now, and you've been going to psychoanalysis. You've been reading philosophy. You've been doing all these things. And here you are, you were drunk again last night. Couldn't you conceive, couldn't you admit that you're an alcoholic? And I'll tell you, if my life depended on it, which it did, if someone had asked me that, if they put a lighter in my arm and I had to make 3 months, I'd say, but I'm not. It isn't the way it looks. You don't understand. And if you say, well, why don't you prove that you're not an alcoholic? Prove that you're not an alcoholic. I couldn't have done that. I wouldn't have the perspective or the knowledge to do that. So I probably would have had to take refuge behind the veneer that frightened, scared people. They shout. I say, oh, get him, leave me alone. Get out of my face. Screw you, leave me alone. I'd rather say that I couldn't say, I don't know. I know now. I've known for many years where I knew I was an alcoholic. I know now, and I've seen it in many, many people I work with, and that's one of the great reasons why I learned it. Let me give you something. If you ever want to learn a lot about yourself, work with newcomers, and you'll see how you look from the outside, and it really looks a lot different. Because as often been said, you know, when I'm working with a newcomer, there's nothing between his problem and my eyes except air, and I can see that. But between my problems and my mind, there's a labyrinth of rationalizations and justifications and explanations and, yes, but that isn't quite the way it is it? No, I can't believe what it is, you know. That's why it's so amazing here that you have to work with others. It's one of the most strange things I remember thinking about is how such things when I was newer, discovering that calling up my sponsor and telling him how I felt was the beginning of making it feel better. And not, what can he possibly say to him? Just the very fact of getting out in the air around you, instead of this continual battling around the labyrinth and maze of that sick mind. But I would have not known how to answer him. But I know now, it's very simple. I know why I felt that way, because based on the experience I had in AA, I knew what alcoholics were. I mean, people here in my first meeting know what an alcoholic is. That's a person who, when they drink, their lives get all screwed up, their emotions get painful, and they just have a hell of a time until finally they're driven to some place like AA. Then they accept them and get them shaped up, and their emotions get straightened out, and their lives get comfortable, and they live pretty comfortably. I know that's true. So I remember two or three times over the years, they still stick in my mind to this day after almost 50 years of listening to, or 45 years, listening to people. I remember sitting in Dallas someplace, the meeting, just would come in. I was working in a big advertising agency. I was having a hell of a time. I was about to lose my job, so I'd sneak away to meetings at noon as though there'd be some spark that was going to change everything. And I remember this guy saying, you know, I haven't seen my two little boys for 5 years. But I'm going to see them this weekend. We're going to go to the zoo, and they're going to have the best time they ever had, and they're going to have a real dad. Remember sitting there thinking in the back row, Jesus, I envy you. I have a whole house full of kids. I dropped some of them off at school this morning, and I'll see them all tonight. And you feel closer to your two little boys you haven't seen in 5 years than I feel to my children that I saw this morning at 10 o'clock. What is that? Remember in San Francisco or someplace, some woman, another thing that stuck in my mind, she said, you men probably wouldn't understand this, but when I drink, I feel dirty inside and out. I bathe and I take showers and I wash, but I never feel clean. I just don't explain it. But since I've been coming to this program and doing some of these things that my sponsor suggests, I'm starting to feel cleaner every day. I start to feel clean inside a little bit. I got a feeling someday I'm going to feel like every woman in the world, ready to be of service. I remember thinking to myself, Jesus, you don't have to be a woman to know that feeling, kid. I felt dirty inside and out since I've been 12 years old. I don't know why, but I just can't scrub it out. That's why I drink. Because when I drink, it goes away. But when I get sober again, there it is. I'm only a little bit dirtier. Remember a guy in Chicago, I guess, Logan Square Group? Big guy, remember that? Upstairs, he said, I've been a vice president of IBM for 5 years. For 3 of those years, I had a hell of a time. I've always felt that I've had to look over my shoulder. They're going to find me out. They're going to find out I'm a phony. I don't do anything. I'm full of lies. I'm just phony. But since I've been coming around here, I'm starting to feel like they got a good man in me, you know that? I don't often feel that, but I'm starting to feel that more every day. I think they're lucky to have a guy like me, because I'm doing a hell of a job for them. Remember those thinking there, saying, oh, I envy you. I wish I had that feeling, because I spent my whole life wondering if they're going to find me out today. I don't even know what they're going to find out, but they're going to find me out. And I know what the alcoholics are, and they come to AA and they get better. And that's why I know I'm not an alcoholic. Now, I drink the same. I drink more than most alcoholics ever know. I can drink a lot of alcoholics on the table. But the reason is this. In some way that I could not identify, my case is 180 degrees different from alcoholics. Unlike them, it is when I get sober and get straightened out, that's when my emotions become hideously painful. And that's when my life becomes unbearable. And the longer I try to do good, the worse it gets. And eventually I can't stand it. And when I drink, I don't drink because I'm a drinker, because I want to run amok through the streets. I drink, damn it, to feel the way you feel when you're sober. That's why I drink. And sometimes I drink too much. And then well-meaning people say things like, oh, you got a drinking problem, son. You ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say, gee, thank you for the advice. But inside of me, a visceral voice just wants to scream, but I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been everywhere. You don't understand. Doesn't anybody understand? What the hell is wrong? And you wind up starting to have problems with drinking. And bad things happen, which makes you feel worse, which makes you have to drink to get rid of the bad feelings. So you wind up in the funniest thing that great many people have. You have to be flamboyant like me to be like a housewife drunk, where you wind up drinking to forget your drinking. Not even, you don't even wind up drinking to forget your drinking, but drinking gets you in situations where you feel bad. And this is the only way to get over feeling bad. So you drink to wind, and people say, well, why do you drink? Don't you know what's happening to you? Don't you even care? And hardly anybody ever thought of the answer to that, but the answer to that, of course, is quite simple. When you think about it later, I care so damn much I can't stand it. That's why I drink. You don't understand. You're a cold, judgmental fish, goddammit. But there's something raw inside of me that I can't handle. And that's why standing outside of the Midnight Mission in the light rain falling this morning, I wouldn't have been able to explain all that, but I felt it, and I knew it viscerally, but I couldn't ever explain it to anybody. But I stood there, and nobody came over to me and talked to me. Nobody said anything. I didn't have to make up I didn't have to give any answers, but it was cold like it was this morning, and I didn't have any. I had a shirt and a pair of pants and no coat. And so I started walking. I walked 71 blocks out to the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, where there's a little AA club called the 6300 Club at that time. And I'd been asked to leave from there a week before for being in there drunk and fighting and denouncing them and acting like a jerk. And they didn't want to re-let me in, but they let me in finally. And I lurked in there, and I hung around, and I just hated it. But not only was an AA club, I've been to all kinds of AA meetings and clubs. I know what AA is. But this was a club that was full of AA fanatics. I don't think hardly anything worse when you're feeling bad than to run across AA fanatics. If you know, you may not know what AA fanatics are like. Well, here's an example. I'm not a mooch by nature. I don't beg. But I sometimes have to let people know what you need so they know how to help you. And I said to myself, I have no place to stay, and I have no money for food, and quite sick, and I had no place to turn. If I just had some help, I'm sure it would be all right. That is just a simple, straightforward statement. Huh? You know what a fanatic say? Go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out. And of course, the correct answer to that is, gee, you're number one with me, sir. I wound up living in the back seat of an abandoned car in their parking lot. And it was just hideous and terrible. And I had no place to turn. I just felt so bad. And I thought to myself, but I really thought a couple times. In Texas once, I had tried to commit suicide and succeeded and had to be brought back to life in order to be put in the insane asylum. Yeah. The highlight of that trip, of course, was that, and I didn't say that, I want to sneak it in because it's Christmas. They saw on my record that I had directed an opera at the University of Texas at El Paso. And when I came out for electric shock treatments, they wanted to give me some occupational therapy, so they had me direct the Christmas pageant to Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas, 1956. And so some of you who are new have not heard this wonderful story about the director's responsibility. It was not exactly as complex as an opera. The director's main job was trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you cross them to the They just want to worship her, Clay, and see. But I remember thinking to myself on a couple occasions, I wonder if my suicide in Texas was successful, and this is what hell is. Just living with scorn and sneering people and people looking at you and treating you badly and no place to turn and nobody cares. I can't think of any better definition of hell. I don't suppose anybody who slept as long as I have who ever stayed sober finally as long as I did. I'm sure there never was anybody like that who doesn't eventually look back and think, what was different this time? What changed this time? What was the difference? You know, that's a big difference from being a guy that knew all about AA and can't stay sober to a guy that's staying sober. How has this brought him up? And I'd like to know that, as I've often said, not for my own information, it'd be nice to know, but I wish I could convey it to people whom I know that are having difficulty and can't stay sober, who are really putting forth, as far as I can see, an effort, but can't stay sober. I wish I could communicate that to them. I wish I could show them, you know. And, because of my long checkered history, people send me people from other parts of the country. There's a couple of people in this room who were sent to me. One guy from Georgia, somebody else from another place. And I had no magic answer for them. They stayed sober finally, but not because of my answer I had for them. I wish I had that answer. I wish I could tell them. I wish I had some sentence. But there is no sentence. It's a sad thing when people come to you and they're desperate. They said to come and see you and you could tell me how to stay sober. And I have to say, I can't do that, pal. I cannot give you sobriety. I wish I could. I'd give anything if I could do it. Because it gets down something I was thinking about a couple of months ago, a little longer than that. But 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, my grandsons, teaching them to ride a bicycle in the driveway in my backyard one Sunday, and watching my grandson, John, topple down. He could not get a bounce. And he got a bloody nose. His arm got scratched. And I'll tell you, I felt I would give anything to take the falls for the kid. Let me fall down. Let me get me bloody nose. Let me scratch my eye. I know how to do that. I can take that stuff, John. But you can't. You have to just pick him up and say, well, John, get back on now. Move your legs and steer. I don't want to do this anymore, Grandpa. Yes, you do. You just don't know it. And he kept riding this old cockamamie bicycle, kept trying. And I'm sure this happened to a lot of people in this room. But the magic of this is this. People that do that, if they keep trying, One day, out of nowhere, and there is some single person in the world that I know of can explain what happens. Out of nowhere, you suddenly, one moment, you suddenly get a sense of balance. And you'll have that for the rest of your life. You can ride bikes for the rest of your life. You never think about it. You can ride motorcycles. You can do anything. But you cannot give that ability to someone for whom you would give your life. I give my life for you, and you mean I can't give you an ability to ride a bicycle? Nope. Can't. And in a much more complex way, this thing called sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous is the same thing. You can't give someone that ability to stay sober. Everybody must be converted to it. This is truly, you know, some people call it this kind of an activist faith, almost not a religion, but a faith. But it must be the only faith in the world where every member is a convert. There's no born and raised members of this faith. Everybody came here knowing secretly it can't work. And that's what makes it so difficult for us. And I wonder why I was successful. It wasn't because I wanted to stay sober, because the only time I ever tried to stay sober very long is I wound up committing suicide in a garage in El Paso. And if a neighbor hadn't found me beat on my chest, I'd have been beat on a gravestone overgrown for a lot of years now. And it wasn't because it wasn't because I had any great breakthroughs or understandings. It wasn't because I don't know why. It was because I look back, and the best thing I can tell you is such a dumb thing. It sounds so stupid. Because I was so frantic, so desperate to get along. It's almost like I was back in that damn ship again at 15. Around people who knew what they were doing and me screwed again and resenting it for it. But having to get along, because I had no place to go. And eventually, allowing me doing the same thing I did in that ship. They didn't say, go down and the engine room gives me a left-handed wrench. But they'll say something equally stupid. Help pick up these chairs. Then somebody can send me up at the bridge to get anything from the captain. They had me go take this action, do this. Do something. Get a sponsor. Got a sponsor. He made me crazy because he just had me doing a series of inane actions. It just apologized to that woman. Why should I? Because you call her a bitch. Well, if you must know, she is a bitch. Nobody cares what you think. Go and apologize. Sorry, you bitch. Go to that stinking job. But Jesus, Father, I used to be an executive. I'm a good writer. They have me wrapping packages for $1.49 an hour. They're screwing me around. Nobody cares. It's the only job you can get. Go to work. Go to that meeting. I don't want to go to that Central Hollywood meeting. It's all weirdos. Geez, they're weird. Some of the men dress like women. Some of the women dress like men. Some guy's got twirly toes, elf boots on. Bela Lugosi goes to that meeting from time to time. You bite your goddamn neck there, Bob. They're weirdos. You fit right in. Go to the goddamn meeting. As far as I can tell, the difference is this. The difference between this time and the other time. Any other time, I would have told him to go get screwed. But this time, I said, and did it. And as far as I can determine, that's the major difference why I'm sober now 37 years. And the man that taught me that has died drunk because he stopped doing it. I wish there was some magic way to tell you, but I think the greatest problem I've ever had here, and I'm sure most of you've had, is that funny little word they call surrender. Surrender. Of somehow acting as though I don't know what's best for me. I might even believe I know what's best for me, but to act as though I don't know what's best for me. To get a sponsor. A person like me, I needed a sponsor. A sponsor was more important to me than Alcoholics Anonymous by far. I knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the sponsor I had did something that they say sponsors shouldn't do. He didn't consult with me. He just told me what to do. Do that! Do that! You know, it's a funny thing. A few years ago, somebody was telling me, you know, isn't it Bob Bailey? He never talked like that. He didn't say, blah, blah, blah. So he always talked in a modulated, pleasant voice. He's an actor. I guess that's right. But I heard him say, blah, blah, blah. He had a certain, maybe it was his eyes adding an overtone to it. I see him every once in a while in old movies. I saw him in a movie about the Saratoga. We played a naval pilot a couple months ago. Really funny to see this slender, nice guy. That's the way I saw myself. He was a tough, overpowering guy. But I gave him that power. He couldn't get that power. You know, as I've said a lot of times, in my area, I'm known as something of a dictator-type sponsor. And people say, oh, you shouldn't be that. But it's impossible to be a dictator-type sponsor without the absolute approval of the dictatee. Because all he ever has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. I've always thought we should have AA police who come in the night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us. A little re-education camp outside of Akron, Ohio. And I suppose the reason I allowed him to do it is because I wouldn't have identified it, but I look now, I respected him. I respected him because I couldn't fool him. I like to have people like me. In those days, everybody does, you know. And I knew ways to make them like me if I really worked at it. But if they liked me, I kind of lost respect for them because they were easy to fool. People who saw through me, I hated. I just soon kill them. But I respected them because they could see through my crap. And that guy saw through me, and he had just a knack of being mean to me at the same time giving me a pat on the back. I forget to mention that sometimes. And saying, you know, you're all right, kid. You're doing all right. Little things like that. So there was not just a stick, but there was a carrot. But he had me take actions that saved my life. I think about that later. Some years later when he had some problems in his life and he got mad at AA because they changed the format of the group. He found the Pacific Islands Age Group. And he stopped going to AA and he tried to go to Synodon and go to work with those people. And pretty soon he took some pills and pretty soon he got drunk and died. Now I got another sponsor. I got a sponsor who perfect AA sponsor, the most active man in the world. And he was my sponsor for 20 odd years, a guy named Chuck C. And there wasn't a week in all those years I didn't talk to him on the phone from wherever in the world I was. But I think to myself, if Chuck C. was my sponsor when I was new, I would have been dead 37 years now. Because he never told me what to do. He shared and he pointed out and we talked about things. But when I got sober and doing well, pretty well, then I could understand what he was talking about. But up to then, it's just conversation. Just talk. Just talk. This man saved my life and got me into active work and got me into habits and got me into doing things that I do to this day. Served me in good stead and enabled me to live. But it makes it kind of, you know, we all like to go around and give simple talks like, here's what happened, folks. I did this and it all changed. But it doesn't work that way. This is life. Life is a series. Life is an endless series of crossroads. And some of them are very poorly marked. And you really don't know which way to turn. And you say, I want to do God's will. You know, on the wall of my office, I have that prayer. It's been quoted by others, but it's best on my wall where I've been for many, many years. It really is the story of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, dear God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not necessarily mean that I'm doing so. But I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. I hope I will always try to please you. And I know if I do this, you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. Because I think that's what it is. We can all talk about God's will and God's knowledge and God speaking through him and me, and but we're fallible human beings, and we're the great curses of the problem, this thing called alcoholism, which turns out I was an alcoholic, but I discovered what alcoholism was. It's true, for those of you who are new, my problem never was really alcohol. It was, but it wasn't. But it turns out there's a name for that condition. It is called alcoholism. And it's made up of people who find sobriety unbearable and eventually find drinking unbearable. And they're caught in the middle. And they all feel their case is different. That funny little paragraph they read at the end of what we read in chapter 3 talks about when people are, well, what have we done? We change from scotch to brandy. We drink beer only. We never drink at the office. We only drink it at the office. We don't drink at home. We read spiritual literature. We do all these things. There's a whole paragraph of things that seem kind of, sometimes people laugh when you hear them. But they're really not funny, because I think that's most of those things I've done, and I'm sure most of those things you've done. Why do you do those sort of things? That's when you've gotten to the crossroad where you can't stay sober and you can't drink. And then you are screwed, and then you start looking for compromises. Maybe if I just drink beer, that'll ease me off and I won't get in trouble. Maybe if I just drink wine. Maybe if I just, you know, all the things. Maybe if I just drink at home. But it's just a continual vain attempt, because I have no knowledge of the fact that as long as the thing that makes me an alcoholic is that alcohol has an unnatural power in my body. So what is that unnatural power? It must have the power to almost instantly make everything all right. I thought it did that for everybody, but it doesn't. It only does that for 6 or 7% of the people in the world who drink. And if it does that, you naturally become dependent on it, and your abilities, already poor, to deal with reality get worse. So you wind up with grown-up brain, grown-up body, grown-up intelligence, grown-up strength, grown-up desires, and all at the intermittent beck and call of distorted perceptions of reality. Till finally the day comes when you must drink. But now drinking is the problem. Now you gotta stop drinking. But you can't stay sober, so you gotta drink. But you can't keep drinking, so you gotta get sober. But you can't stay sober, so you gotta drink. That is called alcoholism. And that is it's a lethal thing. In America, where there's more sobriety today than any place in the history of the world, it is estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk in America. And they die, I'm sure most of them die saying the same thing. They've always said that. I've said and you've said. But I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My case is different. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank to get some relief, for God's sakes, and got a little out of hand. And they don't realize they've just defined the disease of alcoholism. And that's why, if you're new, you've got to remember, getting sober will not make it better. The natural state of sober alcoholics is growing anxiety, depression, frustration. That is what makes alcoholism a deadly disease. If we're just getting off drinking, Christ, we'd all be home free. But you get sober, and eventually sobriety becomes more painful than the memory of drinking. Then eventually drinking gets more painful than the memory of sobriety, and back and forth. And that's what all this is about. That's why we collect in these meetings, and we have sponsors, and we do these things, because we discover that some way that no one can thoroughly describe to this day, that taking a series of actions, whether or not you agree with them or understand them, over a period of time, surrendering your judgment as to what you think is best for you to an overriding thing. And this is true in West Covina, and it's true in Amsterdam, and it's true in Berlin, and it's true in the black meetings and the white meetings and the colored meetings in Cape Town, and it's true all over the world. That surrender to take actions that eventually bring a change about. And that's very hard. And nobody knows it more than me, I guess, than you. Because we're all conditioned all our lives to hearing therapy say, you come to us, we'll change your actions, we'll change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change. And this strange, offbeat, amateurish, hard thing to understand says, you come to us, we will change your actions, and eventually your thinking will change. And it just seems stupid and childish. The other thing in his favor is this. It has rooms like this all over the world. The only sober alcoholics in the world are in Alcoholics Anonymous on a long-term basis. There's no place else. All these other places say, we've got sober alcoholics. You go to them and say, let me see a room full of them, please. Let me see your next meeting of sober alcoholics. This very place it is. And the hardest thing for us to do is to realize what a remarkable miracle Alcoholics Anonymous is. Because we sit around here a while, stay sober, do good, life get in order, and get bored and say, what am I hanging around AA for? And away you go. And it happens to a lot of people. So that's why another reason we get together, to reinforce what we already know. I haven't heard anything new in an AA meeting in 25 years. But I never leave a meeting without feeling better, because I've been reformed and reinforced with the knowledge I already know. And that's why we gather together to deal with these emotions. Our actions begin to change our perceptions. AA very slowly does what alcohol does fast, I believe. Very slow. And little by little, my perceptions change. And yet, inside of me, somewhere, the tiger is sleeping. And I'll guarantee you, when you've been around a while, you watch that tiger roar in people that have done very well for a long time, but they stop taking care of the tiger, and one day the tiger's out and they're gone and they're crazy and they're dead. So what we and I have to do, is remind each other to take care of our tiger, to take certain maintenance steps to make sure that he gets fed and gets his sedation on a regular basis, because left to his own device, I can be dead in no time. So that's why we do these things. That's why one of the reasons this meeting is kind of important. Okay, now in the next few days, as you have the last few days, you're going to be exposed to one of the great all-time socially be acceptable emotional binges called Christmas. I've never met anyone who really got high for Christmas who didn't feel disappointed Christmas afternoon. It wasn't this year either. I didn't get it. I don't know what it was, but I didn't get it. And people are crappy. I want my grandmother to be there, goddammit. But she's been dead since 1953, but I don't care. I want her there. And I want to see my Uncle Vern and my Aunt Elma. That's what I want. Christmas is love and sharing, and not feed that goddamn pony in the rain. So that's why we have to get together once in a while, remind ourselves, Christmas is just really for some people. Now, we had a speaker at our group Wednesday night who says, there's no reason to be depressed at Christmas. Well, he doesn't know. He's a cold fish. To the in crowd, you can find reasons to be depressed anytime. And that's why we have to make sure we remember that Christmas is a nice day, but it's primarily a day. They don't have many good days, you know. We can give that to them. And I walk through it and dance my little dance and whatever they want, I do. But Christmas, I long ago gave up looking for Uncle Vern. I give them Christmas because I got to be a day of joy for me. It's got to be June 7th and March 16th and April 3rd and all the days of the year. And for them, it's just dull days, but they are days that a miracle takes place in my life, because I get up and I take a series of actions and I surround myself with people who reinforce my ability to do it, and I stay sober and I live and I become successful. When I stayed sober this time, and some of you know, I did become successful finally, not very quickly, very, very slow, but I eventually stayed sober and I went to work on time and I did the things, and I got to be an executive and I got to be advertising director, and I got radio and television in Hollywood, and I became quite successful. Another guy and I created the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? And then when I was 15 years sober, that terrible occupational thing kicked in again, that I found myself going to work at the Midnight Mission. Now for 22 years I've run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out. And people say to me, why would you give up your career just